Hello, and welcome to Live Like the World Is Dying, your podcast for what feels like the end times. I'm your host today, Inman Irwin, and I promise that I'm definitely not, I promise there's other hosts still of this show, but everyone's just super busy. And so I've been doing a lot of episodes, and that is great. I love talking. And I specifically love talking about cool things that happen in anarchism. And one cool thing that happens in anarchism sometimes is coming up with creative solutions for trying to figure out more and more how to live outside of capitalism or how to live outside of like really fucked up and exploitative and extractive industries that pretend like they want to do nice things for us, but don't. And so what we're going to be talking about today is manufacturing, and specifically manufacturing by anarchists or anarchist manufacturing, whatever we want to call it. We're going to be talking about not necessarily seizing the means of production, but about creating our own means of production for hopefully living in a less fucked up world. But before all that, we are a proud member of the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts, and here's a jingle from another show on that network. Do 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 do.
Welcome to Molotov Now, a podcast about taking action. In Molotov Now, we analyze and discuss news articles and stories of resistance from around the globe and connect them to our struggles here at home in Aberdeen, Washington.
In the spirit of building solidarity between the rural and the urban, we hope to inspire direct action in the face of oppression and to light a fire to find each other in the darkness.
And we're back. Thanks y'all so much for coming on the show today. If you could introduce yourself with your name, pronouns, and or I guess like what projects are y'all part of, or what do you do in the world? What do world you stuff?
Yeah, hi. I'm Michael or Mike. My pronouns are he, him.
Hi, I'm Alex, pronouns he, him.
Cool. And what stuff are y'all here to talk about today? What do you do? What intrigues you?
Yeah.
What is the stuff that does? I know words.
Right. So we are starting a regulated aid supplies manufacturing project. It's a nonprofit cooperative based in Tucson, Arizona. And this came out of an established radical community center where most of us met. And some are outside of Tucson, but mostly most of us are in Tucson at the moment. The project is called Distributed Medical Device Manufacturing, DMDM for short, and the website is dmdm.icu. And to put it quickly, the mission is to do what we can to get aid supplies into the hands of those that need them while finding funding through a variety of sources, including selling those aid supplies on a sliding scale.
Cool. Hell yeah. That is really freaking cool. How I'm immediately going off of our little script. How did this organization come to be? How did these like balls kind of get rolling, or et cetera?
Yeah, so we started actually, funnily enough, started by listening to your interview with Dr. Lubani, who started the GLIA project, designing open source tourniquets for response in Gaza during the 2018 March of Return. During that interview, Dr. Lubani said, you can make these, but you got to have 3D printing experience and manufacturing experience, and medical device experience, and I was sitting at my office job and thinking, well, heck, I know how to do all that, so I'm going to give it a shot. And 3 years later, here we are. A few of us have also been in the medical device industry and decided we could use our talents to start making these in a more democratic and less profit-driven fashion to get aid into the hands of people that need it a lot quicker and a lot cheaper.
Cool. Hell yeah. No, it was such a delight to have folks from Glia on. I'm curious how, like, in ways that I can imagine, because, you know, people are good at, like, whatever, horizontal, decentralized, etc. But like, or like DMDM is not like a part of Glia or anything. It's just like another project inspired by the work that Glia is doing, or question mark.
Yeah. So Glia, designs open source medical devices. They also manufacture them, but they primarily manufacture them, for Canada and other places in the world, mostly, Poland and Gaza. We're looking to expand on what they're doing and manufacture tourniquets, explicitly in the anarchist space for people that need them that may not be able to afford them as easily. And so we're really trying to continue the great work that's being done in the open source medical movement.
Yeah. Well, hell yeah. I fucking love that. I love a group just being like, there's these people doing these cool things, and we're going to also do those things and figure out how to do them. What skills are kind of like involved in, like, how, like, what did y'all need to learn about to set up this project? Does that
right,
make sense?
So
yeah.
Oh, totally. They're definitely, it's a ton of skills that people already have, and it's just a way to get a different frame of reference. I'll start with the most boring one, and that's quality management. It's something that kind of, makes your eyes glaze over, but it's it ends up being pretty darn important. It's one thing to build a structure together, a greenhouse, and I'd argue even then you need good quality to make sure it doesn't fall down and kill all your plants.
Yeah.
This project takes it to the extreme where we have to ensure that everything that we build, we would be comfortable using it to save the life of our close friends and family, because ultimately the people that end up with these devices will be in that situation, unfortunately. And so kind of taking a strong quality approach is probably the most difficult skill to pick up. It is very teachable. I think in our hearts, all of us want to do the best that we can, and quality is a way to kind of systematize that. Aside from that, sewing is a huge part. So our first project is the Glia tourniquet project that will by no means be our last, and sewing is crucial in that. And we have a local sewing expert, Cecilia. She has gone through industrial sewing training and works with a nonprofit to kind of develop those skills, and we have a place where we can sew, and ensuring every single stitch is as reliable as possible is probably the most important part of the project. 3D printing is another huge part of the project, and that one is great, especially for anarchist projects, because it can be distributed. So you can have different people, people in Philadelphia or people in Colorado, printing supplies that we take in and we inspect and we make sure are good, and then we can integrate into the final assembly. And then things like testing and writing documents. It's kind of funny. I never thought I'd see anarchist procedures, but I think they're a thing of beauty when they're done intentionally.
Yeah, I think that is actually something that we are like uniquely skilled at is act, which is it sounds like an oxymoron, or it sounds like antithetical to what the popular imagination is of anarchism. But like, we're like, y'all ever been to a consensus meeting? We're so good at procedures.
Totally. And this is kind of a more formalized approach to that. We operate entirely on consensus, and we are a flat organization, which is kind of interesting because the FDA regulations that we are following are written for hierarchical structures. And so we have to be a little bit creative in how we write our procedures to follow those regulations while still being actually flat and consensus driven, but we're navigating that, and it's kind of an interesting approach.
Yeah, totally. So it's like if just to understand this kind of like roadmap so far, if say like folks listening to this are like, well, we got 3D printers, we have sewing machines, we have industrial sewing machines. It's like the pieces that people kind of need from this are like so far to be like versed in 3D printing, versed in industrial sewing techniques, and then like being able to like interface with the FDA and do like quality assurance on the stuff that's being made.
Yeah, so I would definitely encourage anybody that's interested in, there's a wide array of open source medical designs out there. It kind of came about, it's been around for a while, but it really took off during the pandemic, and I'm really hoping that that spirit of open source, as far as aid goes, continues. And so there's a lot of interest and a lot of people that are becoming interested in it. And I'd urge people to look into it, but I would caution people that it's really kind of a different risk profile than what other projects. So, making food for the community, or putting together care and harm reduction packages, are done with intentionality and care. It's a little bit different to make a product that, once it leaves your doorstep, it can really impact somebody's life if it didn't go out perfectly. And so I'd urge people to to think about it. And then, one of the aspects of our project is that we plan on open sourcing our entire quality system, so that anybody else that wants to do this will be able to use any of the procedures and materials that we develop. Obviously free of charge. We want this to be approachable, and we want this to be a kind of a self-replicating endeavor.
Yeah. Hell yeah. And it's like I'm just gonna ask leading questions because we're looking at an outline, and that's how stuff goes. There is kind of a need for there's like a hole in or God, what am I trying to say? There is a great need for more tourniquets in the world, specifically in places like Gaza, correct?
There are. At the beginning of the current invasion, the Glia factory in Gaza was bombed. It's out of commission now, and I'm sure, as everybody is aware, it is extremely difficult to get materials into Gaza. Mike, could you speak about our plans on that end?
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into our kickoff project. So we are committing ourselves as our first big project here, our first big manufacturing project, to produce 250 tourniquets to send to aid workers that will take them into Gaza. And so we're doing a crowdfunding campaign for that. We're asking for $10,000. Majority of that $10,000 is going to go to, unfortunately, to the FDA to make sure we're doing this in a way that is in line with regulations and legal. just given the importance of quality and assuring that we're respecting the project. And then the last 2,500 is going to go toward purchasing raw materials. So the Velcro and the plastic for the 3D printing, all the supplies that we would then manufacture and send to aid workers. And as Alex was saying, you know, with the invasion ongoing, getting supplies into Gaza is changing probably per day, maybe even per hour, who knows. Our contacts there, the people from our community that are there doing aid work, tell us that at this very moment, it may not be possible. They have been able to bring in bulk medical supplies in the past. But in the future, it might be a better situation. So by the time we're done manufacturing the 250, we may be able to get them in. Given all of that, we do have a plan B, which is to distribute the supplies to street medics throughout the U.S., throughout the world, just to make sure that they're getting into hands that will use them appropriately.
Yeah. I like this kind of framing of it, especially with like what the situation in Gaza, where it's like, it's, yeah, hearing about how difficult it is for aid to get in, how difficult it is for aid workers to get in, like at all, because of Israel's complete blockade and because of like the whole situation with the Rafah crossing, and Egypt not letting aid in as well. But that it's like, it doesn't mean that that will always be how it is. And it's like good to, it's like still important to like create and plan to get these supplies in, rather than like assume that it's always going to be the case that they can't get in. I like
that. And the reality is that there are many other places that need these tourniquets as well. And I think after this project, that will be the ongoing priority, is to ensure that the tourniquets get to places where they're needed. And that will mean that we'll have to stay in touch with people that are doing aid work in those places. I believe Gaza is absolutely a focus for us at the moment. And it's one that we have connections enough to get aid in eventually, yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah. What has the, I guess, like what is the testing, or like what is the road to like being like, we're going to print, we're going to 3D print tourniquets, and we need them to work and function. What has that process kind of been like?
Yeah, so that's got a strange history behind it. It's kind of shocking to know that there is currently no clinically acceptable standard for testing tourniquets. There are some ways that people do it right now to kind of do the best they can. And so when a company such as CAT or North American Rescue, who supply CAT tourniquets, are testing, generally they're using a training dummy that the U.S. Army uses, which, you know, gives you a reading, but it is not a clinically validated testing method. ATSM, which is an international standard organization, is working on better test standards, but they likely won't be out for quite a while. So OSMS has been working with the University of Western Ontario, and they have developed an open source tourniquet tester. So tourniquets are a little unique in that technically you're not supposed to use them more than once, because you can stretch the inner band and possibly damage some components. So you don't really want to test them each thoroughly. But there are ways to test samples to ensure that the overall lot of tourniquets that you manufacture is safe to use. And so we're using this open source tester. We also did a pilot run of 125 tourniquets that were sent to Utah to be used during a shooting competition, where the participants used the tourniquets on a simulated wound to ensure occlusion was achieved. We supported that test by manufacturing tourniquets in the same way that we would normally. Cecilia sewed 120 of these things out in April. They were sent over for this field trial. They were used, and we had extremely good success. I think there was a sub 1% failure rate, and none of the failures were critical, meaning, you know, maybe a stitch popped or a non-critical piece warped, but all of them achieved occlusion when done by a trained person. And so, you know, it's kind of a long answer, but there's a combination of testing. We want overlapping on real world conditions like that, or as close as you can get, and then also testing materials at the manufacturing level.
Yeah, that is really freaking cool. And it's like this came up with talking with Glia, or like we've had like Four Thieves Vinegar Collective like on as well to talk about like synthesizing like medicine or drugs or like whatever, you know. And it really points to this thing that I think a lot of people, when they hear like 3D printed medical devices, or they hear like anarchist manufacturing or something, I feel like people might immediately start to think of like really like scrappily welded together tall bikes that like punks at like bike co-ops make, you know, of like dubious dubious nature. And like that is like absolutely not what these devices are that are being manufactured by these like open source collectives. It's like it's the like these are professional level things that are being created like on like the same scale, on the same level, if not like exceeding that of like commercially available products, right? This is my thoughts on it, but maybe I'm totally wrong.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think there's still work that we need to do a little bit just to kind of cultivate that skill set that we need to be able to show the world that, hey, we can make things that are reliable and safe without using the traditional structures in capitalism normally implemented to make these. And I think it's a matter of taking on that frame of reference of every single thing that I make, would I be comfortable putting it on to the arm of a loved one when they are in crisis? And if I hesitate on that answer, then I'm doing something wrong and I need to look back at the process. And most importantly, I don't let anything leave my hands and go to a comrade before I would stake my own life on it. And I think there's definitely that passion. And I think it's just a matter of teaching people that, and learning together, that we are able to use some of these skill sets that are traditionally used in manufacturing and quote unquote management, and kind of reclaim them because they are sound and useful and contribute to the safety of our communities.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Can I add a little bit to that?
Yeah, please.
I love that you're pointing this out, because, you know, I appreciate the scrappiness of some anarchist projects, and it can be jarring to some people, but like I love that the philosophy that comes into making some of the scrappier things is that, you know, maybe the project comes out of need. Maybe the tall bike doesn't need to be the prettiest, shiniest, most polished thing in order to do whatever the rider needs it to be. And I think that like that honesty around what a product is can be extended to the tourniquet manufacturing. Like reality is that scrappy approach doesn't apply as well to this. There are parts of this that we can be scrappy about, but like ultimately, to Alex's point, it needs to be something that can save a life and can do the work just as well as any other tourniquet. But what I find to be really interesting about doing this sort of work as anarchists is that this is about how we do the work, and that there are certain things that I think that having an anarchist approach gives us an advantage, in that like there are fewer points of failure with more people working on all the parts, the design, the manufacturing, managing. That if we're making decisions together through consensus, it ensures the power is not concentrated at the top. So shareholder or business owner isn't going to direct the company to reduce quality as a way to maximize profits. Also, information sharing. I love that like this project came out of open source designs that were really shared on the internet. And having gone through the GitHub for that, it's extensive. You get CAD files, you have manufacturing documents, you get all kinds of information, knowledge that's been shared for the greater good. And so that's something that like, if that work is done in capitalist industry, that knowledge is usually guarded as a secret. And so sharing that knowledge means that we can share designs that work. We don't have to reinvent it every project. Every time somebody wants to spin up manufacturing, they don't need to reinvent this and make all of the same mistakes, which in the context of tourniquet manufacturing means failures and potential loss of life. So I really love that. I think taking an anarchist approach to these kinds of projects, I think really changes it for the better.
Yeah, it really does. And it's like, yeah, there are learning curves to get through. But like, when people bring up apprehension around manufacturing on this level and for these purposes, like, and show like a lot of apprehension about it, it's like I find myself getting this frame of being like, oh, okay, well, like this thing is produced by an industrial process that's been like done for like the last like 30 years or whatever. It's a tried and true method. And then I'm like, but it isn't. They're like, I mean, or it's like sometimes, and sometimes it isn't. And sometimes it's like sometimes in this capitalist structure, or lots of times in these capitalist structures, it's like they skimp on quality to like maximize profit, or they create things that purposefully actually don't work. It's like in the realm of like shit you buy on Amazon, where you're like, is the thing that I bought even going to do its primary function in like a, like for more than 2 seconds or something? It's like,
you can buy tourniquets on Amazon.
Oh my God.
And who knows what the level of quality is there? I think maybe, I don't know if you want to speak to that, Alex. Like, I think you were the one who told me that.
Yeah. So I have a, my hobby is hunting counterfeit medical devices on Amazon, of which there are a tremendous amount. And I have a fun collection of images showing the use of the tourniquets. So tourniquets are used for arterial bleeding occlusion. And most of the tourniquets you can find on Amazon will have a Photoshop picture of a little kid having a tourniquet applied to their scraped knee.
Oh, my God. What?
And I've ordered several of these tourniquets to test myself, and they fail almost immediately. And It is very much like what you just said, Inman, in that we are conditioned to believe that if something comes in a slick package from a quote unquote factory, that there's an inherent level of trust. And I know that there are people walking around with these Amazon tourniquets in their IFACs right now. And the reason being is that it is quite expensive to buy if you have the money, by all means, buy a North American Rescue tourniquet. Those are extremely reliable and well produced. We are trying to make sure that nobody has to buy a counterfeit tourniquet because they know that they believe they need one in their IFAC to aid their community, but they don't have the funding to buy the gold standard. We are trying to fill that need. And my other hobby is reporting to the FDA, and they haven't taken me up on any investigations yet, but who knows?
That's, God, I mean, it's like no surprises where I'm like, it's like we have these myths all the time that like, oh, well, surely like an organization like the FDA will at least like do its job, like we expect the EPA to, but you know, the EPA and the FDA let us down all the time. But it's like I'm sure the FDA would be quick to jump on like groups like GLIA or groups like y'all for like not doing something, but the fuck if they're gonna like do anything to these companies that are like selling shit that doesn't work, you know? That is frustrating.
Yeah, and to that end, that's why we are asking for this extra money, is that we plan to do this by the book. We're going to get full FDA registration. Between our group, we have around 20 years experience in the medical device industry. I'm a quality engineer by trade, and we want our registers with the FDA, it's done the right way to make sure that we don't spoil it for anybody else that wants to go down this road too.
If you want to support as a listener that campaign to get registered with the FDA and make the 250 tourniquets for Gaza, we're going to be linking to the crowdfunding campaign on the website, which is dmdm.icu.
Cool. If I was going to ask this later, but it's coming up now. Are there other ways that groups around the world can support this effort other than contributing money to it? Or if like someone's local makerspace is like, we want to help with making these 250 tourniquets or more, can they link up with y'all? Or
absolutely, we're always looking for help with documentation is a big one. It is the least exciting aspect, although some weird people like me enjoy that part. And if anybody is excited by the prospect of sample plans and writing procedures and inspection reports, we would love to have you help out. Aside from that, we are also looking into ways to have reliable 3D printed parts be manufactured offsite. There are some ways to do that under the regulations of FDA. It wouldn't require the person 3D printing to have registration, but there would definitely need to be kind of more than a casual relationship between their group and ours. And so there are a ton of opportunities for collaboration. The one thing at the end of the day is that FDA registers per facility, and so it'll have to be a single spot for right now where the tourniquets are assembled and packaged and sent out the door. But there's definitely ways. Anybody that's interested, by all means, reach out. If you're looking to volunteer, I'd also urge, if you're interested in starting something similar, I would highly recommend reaching out to us or GLIA to get some perspective from people that have already been down this road, and so we can help make sure you don't fall into the same traps.
Hell yeah. I feel like we already kind of talked about this, but I just want to make sure that we got it all. Talking about how to actually the steps for making these. Do y'all feel like we talked about this already enough, or do you have anything that you want to add to it?
It's not the most exciting topic. I think I could go through it real quickly if you'd like.
Yeah, maybe just like a quick little bulleted. I feel like I'm looking at the outline and I'm like, I feel like we've talked about most of these.
I think it's exciting. I also think there's a lot of value in demystifying a process like this. Like,
great.
Making people feel empowered that, like, yeah, it's kind of daunting taking on something like this, but it is actually something that, with the right training, the right approach, the right skills, can be done by many people.
Cool. Yeah, let's go through it. How do you make a tourniquet? Tell me, and I'm not going to do it, but I will know how to do it.
Yeah, sure. So most important thing first is sourcing materials. So we find the materials that we need, and this is a little bit different than what a lot of people are used to, in that you can't really find a material that you think might work in place of the one that's specified. There are ways to do it, but it requires a lot of intentionality and a lot of documentation. And so finding the right materials in the right amounts, getting them all together, double checking, making sure they're the right materials and the ones specified by, in this case, Glia, who's the designer, and then cutting everything to size. And then we have Cecilia and her group sew them together. Then we receive in the 3D printed parts from the people that print them for us offsite, and we inspect every single one of those. And we integrate them onto the sewed subassembly. And once the tourniquet is put together, we inspect the whole thing top to bottom for any defects. Any defects we find, we snip the tourniquet, make sure it's destroyed so it can't be used. And then we select a certain percentage to test to destruction using the open source tourniquet testing device, so that we can ensure that a representative sample has been tested and the lot has been properly vetted. And it's important to kind of do things in a lot manner so that you can't really change things one lot to another unless you document it. And then that way, if we make a lot and then, Cecilia comes back and says, hey, it'd be better if we did it this way, we can look into the change, we can do a risk assessment, we can document the change, we can validate the change, and then in the next lot, we can implement the change and maybe test a little bit more vigorously, but we're making sure we don't do any changes within a lot. So that was a little bit quality heavy discussion, but that's essentially it. It's the devil's in the details. I think anybody with a sewing machine and a 3D printer could make one of these in a day, but I'd argue it takes, probably a month of concerted effort to make one of these that you would feel comfortable using in field conditions.
Yeah. And what are, just to kind of break down the pieces, so it's like there is a piece that is 3D printed. What is that piece that is 3D printed?
Yeah, so there's actually a few. There's the main buckle, so kind of going from the top to the bottom of a tourniquet, you have the main buckle, and then that buckle is capturing the internal strap, the back strap, and then part of the front strap. And the inner strap is made of nylon that has a very low low amount of stretch. Mm-hmm. And that is what applies the compressions. The back strap just contains the inner strap, and then the front strap is where the Velcro is, and that we'll get to that in a second. So going further down, you've got the windlass. That's the big bar in the middle. That's what the operator turns to constrict that inner strap and get occlusion. And then you have a backing plate, and that keeps everything from sliding around on that pressure point. And then you have a clip, and the clip is integral because it keeps the windlass in position after tension has been applied. And then the rest of it is basically a strap with Velcro. We use a Velcro type called OmniTape because it has the hook and loop already integrated into it, and it makes the manufacturing a lot more simple. And the more simple you can make manufacturing, the safer it is. And all the way at the end, you have a little tab that you put a piece of colored fabric on so that the operator can easily find the tab. And when you go to use it, you tighten the band as much as you can. You apply the Velcro so it doesn't move, and then you turn the windlass until you achieve occlusion. You clip it into that clip, and then you you write the time it was applied onto a fabric tab that's included on the clip.
Hell yeah. And what kind of material is used for the 3D printing? I know there's a lot of different plastics. I don't know anything about 3D printing except that you can make cool things with them, and that there's different goos that are used. I'm going to call it goos.
Sure. So, you know, the Glia design is pretty darn robust. If you're in a situation like Gaza where you may not be able to get the best materials, you can print it out of anything like PLA, for example. In, you know, we have the privilege of being able to source material with ABS or PETG. The reason being is that it has a higher glass transition temperature. So if you were to store your 3D printed tourniquet in the car, if it was made of PLA, it probably wouldn't survive direct sunlight for very long, whereas ABS and PETG are a lot more robust. We're using 3D printing right now. In the future, we're definitely looking at moving over to injection molding, which I think we can do on the community scale. There's been some experimentation with that.
Nice. What we've talked about this a little bit, but I know y'all have other things you want to say about it. What is the important, and this is kind of the core of the episode, you know, whether it's 3D printed tourniquets or whether it's whatever other devices that are being created, but what is the importance of the role of manufacturing things as anarchists?
Yeah, so I'll give my two sentences, and then Mike, if you could. So I think the main importance is that the current system is designed to maximize profitability above all else. And we saw where that philosophy broke down during the COVID pandemic, when just-in-time manufacturing caused massive supply chain issues, which I would argue directly contributed to the worsening of people's lives. I think we saw the need for community-level manufacturing of the items that we need to ensure our own survival, because we have seen that capitalism won't be there when things get rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the point that we could talk all day on this. I mean, it touches so many different parts of our lives. And I know for us and our conversations about it, the thing that we landed on has been talking about it as autonomy as the goal. And that's, you know, this project as well as other projects like it, this approach to manufacturing from the anarchist direction, and not being beholden to capitalist interests to meet our needs. So it's incredibly empowering realizing we can meet our needs together instead of relying on what is, as Alex said, maybe not a reliable system, a little bit backwards, but relying on capitalist industry that where their goal is not necessarily quality, it's for short profits, that we can rely on each other instead. And that's central to my view as an anarchist. And I believe we can create new ways of living outside of the the extractive existing economy. And I think as a way to get there, we need to start manufacturing things in a way that distributes wealth and power, both to the workers that are doing the manufacturing and to the community in which that manufacturing is a part of, instead of concentrating it in the hands of a few shareholders. And doing that work as a non-hierarchical, democratic, worker-owned organization, I think is key, because as anarchists, we know that kind of structure works. And for all the reasons we talked about, I think earlier, than like fewer points of failure, decision-making being distributed and not concentrated at the top, and the knowledge sharing being a huge one as well. And the quality that Alex has been mentioning, that is the top priority in this project. And like, profits aren't going to touch that.
Yeah, I feel like in any framework, a project that is motivated by profit at all will not have quality as its top priority, just by nature of that structure.
Yeah.
And I would like to mention that we are following in the footsteps of a lot of really cool organizations. If there's any good news, there are already tons of people working crazy hours on stuff like this. So they're already involved in this space, and a few really good examples are the Heater Block project that came out of Portland, where they designed a low-cost portable heater for the unhoused population, and they have been wildly successful in exporting that model to community aid groups all around the country. So we already have this type of work going on. Something a little bit more in the medical space is a group out of Berlin called CADIS, and they are everywhere. They have had medical device trucks that they manufactured assisting in Iraq and Northeast Syria and Ukraine, and currently in Gaza. They are just an amazing group that's doing incredible work, and we are definitely trying to contribute to what they are already pioneering, just in our unique way of more manufacturing focused on aid supplies. And then there's other groups, you know, that are out there, like OSMS and GLIA, that are just doing incredible work on the design side and on the manufacturing side for open source medical devices. So the good news is that this is already underway. We're just trying to add to it in any way that we can.
Cool. Yeah, those heater blocks seem really cool. I really want to have folks on to talk about building heater blocks sometimes. Especially in the there's this whole world of like shit on YouTube where people are like, look, you can make a heater out of some candles and these like terracotta pots, and everyone's like, please, dear God, don't make these. They will burn your house down. And so I'm pretty interested in how these heater blocks work. We're kind of nearing the end of our time. Is there anything else that y'all want to talk about in regards to anything we've already talked about, or any things that we didn't talk about that you're like, why weren't we asked about this? Shakes my fist at Inman.
I think we covered everything that was on my list. Maybe just to reiterate the fundraising campaign, if that's an important one. You can get the details at our website, dmdm.icu.
Cool. You got anything else, Alex?
I think that covers it.
Great. Well, thanks y'all so much for coming on today, and we will share the links in the show notes for anyone who wants to go find this project to donate to. Please donate to it. Please form your own little group. Form an entire network of people making cool stuff. I'm know how to say all the words. And if you like this podcast, then 3D print medical devices and then get them to people who need them. I was thinking about this throughout the show, but I think about how there's so many. It's when people think about 3D printers, what I think about mostly, because I'm a D&D nerd, is how you can print D&D miniatures on your 3D printer. And if you can print the detail of little tiny swords and belt buckles on tiny little miniature objects, then you can print 3D printed medical devices and get them to cool people. You can print your D&D miniatures and medical devices. Do both.
Tiny tourniquets for your D&D miniatures as well.
You can print tiny tourniquets for your D&D miniatures and also big tourniquets for people to use. If you enjoyed the show, you can also tell people about it. It's the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell people about it, talk about it, listen to it. And the other best thing that you can do for the show is to try some of the stuff that we talk about on the show, because that's how these cool projects emerge, is just by people hearing about something, finding a need for something, and then figuring out how to do it. And that is the single best thing that you can do for this show, is to live like the world is dying, because it might be. You can also support the show by supporting our publisher, Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness. You can support them/us by buying books from us. You can also support us by supporting our Patreon at patreon.com/strangersinatangledwilderness, which comes with a variety of rewards, tiers, and tiers of support. Anything from discounts to free digital material, to you can get a cool zine mailed to you every month, to you can get us to thank or acknowledge cool spaces or cool people or cool concepts or cool dogs. And we would like to thank these people and places. Thank you, Connor, Bartholomew Spawn Doom, Jason, which is not a real name, Aiden, Alium, Amber, Ephemeral, Appalachian Liberation Library, Portland's Hedron Hackerspace. Hey, Portland's Hedron Hackerspace. Maybe y'all want to print cool 3D medical devices. Maybe you already do. I don't know. Boldfield, E. Batoli, Eric, People's University of Palestine, Julia, Catgut, Marm, Carson, Lord Harkin, Trickster, Princess Miranda, Ben Ben, Anonymous, Janice and Odell, Allie, Paparuna, Milica, Boise Mutual Aid. Hey, Boise Mutual Aid, what projects do you work on? Theo, Hunter, SJ, Paige, David, Dana, Chelsea, Starro, Jennifer, Kirk, Chris, Micaiah, Nicole, Tikva the dog, and the eternal Haas the dog. Mike and Alex, do you have any people, organizations, or cool dogs that you want to thank today?
I'd definitely give my shout out and love to Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. I heard Cat got in there, so saying hey to her specifically. And my dogs, Lily, too, and Russell. Thanks for waking me up way too early every morning.
Thank you, Lily and Russell, the dogs. Mike, you got anything?
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to the other folks involved in the project. Thank you for letting us represent you, and hopefully we did it true to your expectations, and look forward to continue making this happen. And Got my partner's dog here, not a little dog, big Nina, that is somehow sitting outside in the Tucson heat, but enjoying it.
Thank you, Nina the dog. So many dogs, all the dogs. Portland's Hadron Hackerspace and Boise Mutual Aid, not a call out. I'm assuming y'all do cool things and we should talk about them sometime. Thanks everyone so much, and we will see you next time, and we hope everyone's doing as well as they can with everything that's going on.